Órale pues, Raza, welcome to Chicano Highlights. I am your host, Beto, Beto Man, and we have a very special guest here with us today, Mr. Héctor González from Rampart Records. How are you doing, compañero?
Oh, that sounded beautiful, Héctor González. I'm doing great.
All right, my friend. We're going to start off with your background. ¿De dónde son tus padres?
They're from El Rosario, Sinaloa, is where my family on my father's side is from originally, and they came from Mexico and settled in the Bunker Hill section of downtown L.A. after World War II, so in like the late 40s they came.
Right. And how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have four brothers. No sisters, just four brothers.
All right. And so then you grew up in L.A., ¿verdad?
Yeah, I kind of grew up in the downtown Bunker Hill area, downtown L.A., and then finally we settled in the South Central Watts area. I was born at Hoover Street Hospital in the South Central Watts section of L.A., and coincidentally, Steven Chavez, who is the captain in charge of, or the commander in charge of EastLARadio.com, EastLAReviewRadio.com, his mother spent a lot of time at working at Hoover Street Hospital. And the girl whose record we're going to be putting out, Veronica Carrillo, she was born at Hoover Street Hospital. So I can't get it out of my sight.
Wow.
Steve has the original scale, and he promised he was going to leave it to me in his will.
All right. All right. So let's where did you go to elementary to middle school and high school?
Catholic school. We were in located off of Broadway, and I was interesting that I went to St. Columbkill's Catholic school, and that was a school that was basically centered around the First Order of German nuns who came from Germany, of course, as Sisters of Notre Dame. Rough school in terms of the discipline. They taught us French. They taught us Latin. I was an altar boy, and I stayed there pretty much until the beginning of the seventh grade, and then the Watts riots happened in 1965, and we were right in the epicenter of the Watts riots. And after the riots, anyone that was in black moved out of the area in fear that the riots would come back again. Los Angeles Times refers to it as the white flight.
Wow.
So we headed east on Florence, because we were like near Gage and Florence and Broadway, and we headed east, and we ended up in the city of Bell Gardens. We moved there for a little bit. We lived there for a while. I attended Bell Gardens Junior High School, and then we finally settled in the city of Bell, and that's where I went to junior high at Nimitz in Huntington Park, and then I graduated from Bell High School in 1972. So it was an interesting childhood, because I didn't really grow up around Mexicanos or raza, because I wasn't from East L.A. You know, I kind of grew up around blacks. You know, that was the whole epicenter of the neighborhood that I kind of lived in. And then all of a sudden, after the Watts riots, you know, we moved to Bell, and Bell High School was about 90% white. There were no Mexicans at Bell High School. And recently, I played at my 40th Bell High School reunion, and one of the kids who was with us at the event said to me, "Man, because didn't you go to school with any Mexicans? Because there's nothing but white people here." I go, "Yeah, that's the way it was."
That's the way it was, yeah.
But, you know, that was a good education, too, because they opened another side of me in terms of my career in music, you know, that I think was part of my destiny. So I had to kind of go through that journey.
Wow. You know, but it's very interesting, because you don't have like a slang, a black slang, right? There's Chicanos that grow up in a black neighborhood, right? And they end up having that slang or adopting the black culture. You don't seem like you've done that.
Well, no, I studied acting. I wanted to be an actor. And so, you know, I had to work on my pronunciation and my vernacular and all the things that kind of go with that. And so I've lost a little bit of it. You know, every once in a while, you know, if I'm talking musician jive, then that's another thing. If I'm in another character and I'm playing music, you know, you may hear a little bit more of that than you're hearing on the radio right now.
Right.
Because I'm not in character as a musician. But, yeah, that's a lot of the Chicano musicians that I know, including Renny Flores, the drummer. He's from South Central. Veronica Carrillo, Hank Castro, the phenomenal singer, Chicano singer. He's from South Central. So we our musical personality is a little bit different because we have that black influence. And you know, Bethel, one of the things that was interesting, Bethel, man, about growing up in South Central is that I lived about 10 blocks from the legendary 5-4 Ballroom, which was on 54th and Broadway. And back in its day, even, you know, up to the 70s, and even more recently when they tried to reopen it again, that was the epicenter of rhythm and blues and L.A. And I remember coming home from altar boy practice at St. Columbkill School, and I would walk by there, and I was fascinated to see the tour buses, you know, and you're talking about Big Mama Thornton, you know, James Brown, you know, all the legends of R&B music were playing at this club. And Billy Diamond, who later became the curator for the 5-4 Ballroom, was actually the upright bass player with Chuck Berry, with Fats Domino, with Little Richard. And I met him. I actually tried to sneak in when I was a kid, and he caught me. And he scared me, and he made me cry, and I think he felt so bad, he went over and got me a Coke to try to calm me down. But years later, when I was an adult, I came back with my wife, and I introduced her to Billy Diamond, and I dedicated my Love and the Hot Rocks album to him, because, you know, it was interesting that I would even get to meet a legendary guy like that at that age, not realizing that years later, I myself was going to become somewhat of a famous or popular bass player in my genre of music.
All right. So let's before we get into the music, let's talk a little bit about the politics, the civil rights. I mean, that was a very turbulent time. From your memory, what do you remember?
You know, Moctezuma Esparza asked me that question when we were working on Walkout, and I hate to say that it kind of passed me by. Because he even made a joke about me going to Bell High School. He says, well, I think they supported the walkouts, but I think maybe one person walked out. Because, again, you know, it was 90%, there were 90% Anglos, you know, and and those of us that were there, we didn't even realize that that was going on. So that kind of all passed me by because, again, I wasn't from East L.A. So that didn't come into my life until a little later when the East L.A. riots happened. And I was in high school, and I remember the L.A. sheriffs going down Atlantic towards Whittier Boulevard, and there were like 6 sheriffs in every unit, you know. And, you know, we know the rest is history, you know, how violent that got, you know. But I always thought that sometimes our police, and it was very evident even back then, you know, can be very aggressive and sometimes very trigger happy. And I kind of felt from the footage that I've seen that it was kind of provoked by the LA sheriffs.
Right, exactly. And so then, let's talk a little bit about music. Were you a musician?
Well, yeah, you know, musicians become musicians because listening is just not enough. You're listening to music and you just want to be part of it. It's, you know, just like my career in television. You know, I would watch the TV as a kid, but watching the TV wasn't good enough. I wanted to know what was like, where that picture was coming from and how that came through that TV. So that's the same thing with music. And my father was an entrepreneur, and he had these beer bars where they had live music. And I kind of grew up with a lot of Mexican actors and Mexican wrestlers and great Mexican musicians. You know, back in that time, and I think a lot of people today perhaps don't know, or those of us that do know take it for granted, as Mexican Americans, Chicanos, we just couldn't walk into any bar or any restaurant or any movie theater at any given time of the week. You know, we weren't even allowed to swim in the county public swimming pools until the last day of the month before they cleaned out the pools, and then the Anglo kids could come back and we'd have to wait a month to get in there. I mean, that's the way it was. So my father, being a club owner and a bar owner, a lot of those Mexican artists and movie stars and actors would come and patronize my dad's place. And I got to meet a lot of those actors.
All right.
Growing up.
Now, what was the name of the bar?
It was called he had a place called El Quinto Patio that was named after, I think, a song that was recorded by Los Panchos. And then he had another place called El Zurdos, because he was, my dad was a lefty. And in Spanish, a lefty is zurdo. So they called it Zurdos Bar.
Where were those located?
They were located in the downtown area near the Olympic Art. Let me say that again. They were located in the downtown L.A. area, and some of them near the Olympic Auditorium, and that's where I got to meet the Mexican wrestlers. But one person in particular that was very close to my friend, I'm sorry, one actor and one person in particular that I remember as a child who was very close to my father and actually started my career in television was an actor by the name of Rodolfo Acosta. Rodolfo Acosta was one of the Mexican actors, many Mexican actors, or one of the many of the Mexican actors who came to this country and their career in film took off in American film, not in Mexican films. So Rodolfo Acosta had worked with Elvis Presley, he'd worked with Barbara Eden, he'd worked with John Wayne, he'd worked with Gary Cooper. He usually played the Indian, or the main Apache Mexican Indian that spoke Spanish and stuff. His performances were great. So I remember I was around 12 years old, 13 years old, and he was at the house having menudo. My dad was with him. And he looked at me and he said, hey, ¿qué vas a hacer en la vida? ¿Qué quieres hacer con tu vida? You know, what do you want to do with your life? And I told him, Hollywood. I just wanted to be part of Hollywood. That was my whole fascination was, I didn't realize it there in Beto Man, but I guess I just wanted to be a part of the Hollywood entertainment industry, which is what I work in today. And he said to me, well, he said, maybe I can help you out. And they had just cast him as one of the ranch hands in the NBC television series High Chaparral. And they were doing the exteriors and most of the filming in Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, in those movie ranches that had been out there for years. But the interiors, like the classrooms and things like that, were being done at the Burbank Studios in L.A. So I got a few roles as an extra. But the most important thing, Beto Man, was I got my California entertainer license or permit to work in the entertainment industry. I still have it. I was 13 years old. It was 1967. I'm 63 years old. So I am currently celebrating my 50th anniversary as a working pro in the Hollywood entertainment industry.
Wow.
Now, how things happen sometimes, you just kind of, we got our path and you just got to follow your journey.
Exactly. What other jobs have you held throughout your career?
Well, I had my group Eastside Connection with Rampart Records, and we had a lot of success, you know, American Bandstand, Dick Clark, Raider Records, you know. And by 1980, the band broke up, and I took it really hard and very emotional about it. And I wanted to get out of the music business for a while. I was kind of burned out. You know, we've been traveling on the road, being a band leader. Just being in the music industry is bad enough, but being a band leader comes with a whole other set of responsibilities where you're basically responsible for a lot of stuff. And I was pretty young. I was in my early 20s, and I plowed into this, you know, got us a booking agent, you know, and you got to play the commissions to the booking agent. You got to pay the money to the band. You got to make sure the vehicles are gassed. You know, it's a lot of responsibility, and I wanted a break, and I had experience, Beto Man, in audio, sound. And because I wanted to work in television, I started to pursue a career working as a television engineer. And lo and behold, a gentleman by the name of Gus Dotto, a Mexicano, who worked at the KABC studios on Prospect and Talmadge in the Silver Lake, I hooked up with him and he gave me an interview. And they were hiring. And I got hired as a studio field engineer at the ABC television studios right after the ABC Winter Olympics at Lake Placid in 1980. We were the first of the new breed of engineers who were being hired. And I just was so blown away because here I was on this famous television lot. And, you know, I got into sound and I wanted to do that job which is known as the front PA house mixer, which means you sit in the audience and you mix the sound for the audience. And I ended up with that gig, and I did the Lawrence Welk show. That was an incredible thing. I did American Bandstand with Dick Clark, and I spent a lot of years with Richard Dawson and Mark Goodson on Family Feud. And that just kind of, I was there from 1980 to about 1987, and I left because Univision offered me an incredible position. So I left ABC TV. But prior to leaving ABC TV, Bethelmann, I was promoted to the news department. My son went to the Blessed Sacrament Catholic School in Hollywood, and Bert Tapia, who was the head of the West Coast ABC Network News Bureau, his daughter went to that same school, and we'd run into each other, and he knew I worked at ABC, and he offered me a job at Chicano, looking out for another Chicano, which is rare because we don't get in those positions, and next thing I know, I'm on Good Morning America.
Wow.
But Bethelmann, I almost got killed. I wasn't on there very long before the scheduling supervisor made a mistake and sent me to the White Aryan Supremacist Conference in Lake Hayden, Idaho, which was 17 miles from the Canadian border. I'm talking about absolutely beautiful God's country, okay? So what was the problem? They had requested an all-white crew. What, is ABC racist? Is there prejudice problems, issues? No. They requested an all-white crew because only whites were allowed on the compound. See? So by accident, they put me on the crew. And when we left LAX, the cameraman and I'm doing sound, we end up in Spokane, Washington, and we run into the producer from Good Morning America and the director, and they took one look at me, Bethelmann. And the producer says, "What in the hell are you doing on the crew?" He says, "Your presence in the crew can endanger the rest of us, and I don't think you're going to be able to join us on this." But the problem was, is this is a Good Morning America. We're going live. Okay, this is serious television broadcasting, and they couldn't replace me. There was no way to send me back. What are they going to do? They're going to send me back and bring in another dude? This is not going to happen that way. So what did they do, Bethelmann? They stuck me in the back of the engineering van with all the equipment, and they covered me with a furniture blanket, and they snuck me on the compound. Right? Okay, so every time, you know, I got in there, right by the building where we were going to set up the interview with the two leaders of the Aryan Nations were going to be interviewed. And I'm in this building unloading the equipment. And immediately these young girls came over and took pictures of us and asked us for our names. I told them my name was John Wayne. I wasn't going to give them my real name. You know, there was just no way. But when we got there, and I know you're going to edit this out, but I want to tell you, when I got there, they were chanting, "Down with kill the Jews." That's what they were chanting as we were unloading the equipment in a building that looked like a church, and inside of that building was literature that was pretty bizarre. I tried to get some, but I couldn't because they were watching me, but they had like a picture of a black guy with a white girl in a wedding, like they're getting married, with a circle and a slash. And there was, like, it was just the literature alone was enough to scare you into thinking, man, what am I doing here, right? So anyway, to make a long story short, the cameraman, Bud Holland, says to me, "Hector, I don't want to go live on the air and have a battery go bad on me, so why don't you go out to the van and bring me in the batteries, put them on the charger, and let's get ready in case something goes wrong, right?" So I go out to the van, and I guess a soldier from the Aryan Nations found out that a Mexican had snuck into their compound. And the guy was waiting for me on the church steps as I was walking in with the batteries. And he puts his hand on his knife. And this guy didn't have like a filete or like a cuchillo or like a homie. This guy had like a Crocodile Dundee knife. You know, like, yeah. Oh, man. He put his hand on this knife and he said, and I know you're going to edit this out, but he said to me, because I'm going to slit your throat and I'm going to kill you, or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess the cameraman, Bud Holland, must have gotten a bad feeling, because he was an older man. He was older than me. He was old enough to be my dad. He was like one of the first cameramen they hired at ABC when they were doing Space Patrol in 1951. So this guy was a veterano. And so all of a sudden, he's at the entrance of the church, right on the porch, and he yells out to me, "Hey, Hector, how long is it going to take you to get those batteries?" And it was enough to distract the dude with the Crocodile Dundee knife, and I snuck in, got in there, and just then, the two leaders of the Aryan Nation that we were going to interview walked in, and the dude disappeared. He split. But that was like a scary situation. You know what was really a trip, Ethel, man? Was the two leaders of the Aryan Nations that we were there to interview, they're really cool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're doing, like, audio and you're doing a show like that, you got to dress the mic. You just can't put the mic on them. I mean, this is network television. This is ABC Good Morning America. Mm-hmm. Right? So you have to ask people sometimes, and this happened to me with President Nixon. You have to ask people sometimes to take off pieces of their clothing. Mm-hmm. And they were so cooperative, because I had to get the guy to, you know, take off his coat so I could dress the mic through his tie and put the clip on there and then wrap the back of the cable. And, man, they were super cool to me. I mean, I didn't feel any tension at all, but as soon as we finished the interview, the cameraman and I, we packed everything up and we got out of there.
Y como dijo John Wayne, vámonos.
It's vámonos time. So that was my career at ABC TV, and I left and eventually ended up at CBS. And I won an Emmy while I was at ABC for Outstanding Technical Achievement in Live Sound for ABC Sports for the 84 Summer Olympics. And that Emmy changed my life. And I always tell people when I lecture and I tell students that I was so fortunate to have won. First of all, I was the first Chicano to ever win a primetime Emmy. Second of all, I won it when I was 32 years old, so I was young, and I could benefit from it. If I won it now, it's like a doorstop. Hey, why don't you put it over there? Hey, it's in the way. It's something for my cats to play with. But when you're 32 years old and you win a primetime Emmy, oh, man. It was like definitely, like, so what do I mean when I say it changed my life? Well, now you're a winner. And now the production companies are putting you everywhere. And so I was doing, like, everything from Who's the Boss, Mr. Belvedere, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, Silver Spoons. I mean, I was the king of the game shows, and I was doing all the sitcoms and game shows, like where I got kind of stuck, you know. It's interesting because I noticed that as far as racism in television, you'd see the white guys would end up on sports and they would end up on the news where the big money was. And the Mexicans and the blacks, we got the game shows and the sitcoms.
Okay. But that's a very good, notification, because a lot of people don't realize those things, you know.
You know what shocked me when I was I got to ABC TV and I went out, you know, to do a couple of sporting events. I couldn't believe that you're talking about like who's the greatest athletes in the world. We know are African Americans. I mean, come on. So you're gonna have ABC Sports, wide world of sports. That's what was happening when I was in television, Monday Night Football and all that. And you're not gonna have one black cameraman on the crew, mm-hmm. when there's tons of black cameramen, but they're all on the game shows and on the sitcoms with me. So when I got there, the African-American cameramen had gotten together and had filed a class action suit against ABC Network and ABC Sports in hopes that, they could get on the crew. Because sometimes even the black athletes would say, "Hey, man, you guys ain't got no brothers on camera." I mean, I was there. I heard it myself. Come on. And you know what was sad? The union at that time was NABET, and that's the National Association of Broadcast Technicians and Employees. And we're all members of that Hollywood Labor Trade Union, and that union got an arbitrator, and they sued ABC Sports, he lost. ABC won. And I remember the union was saying in the lounge, we were all in the lounge, and they were saying that ABC had the money because it was so wealthy, such a powerful company, to be able to pay off the arbitrators. And so what's the bottom line on this? All this effort to keep blacks off this crew for the sports. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, man, I just... So that was like my first introduction to see like that, unfortunately, as great of a job and as great of a career as that was, the racism was still there.
Yeah.
It's still there. Yeah. Still there even today.
Yeah. Some people skate through life never really realizing it until it hits them, until they see it for themselves. Other than that, it doesn't exist.
Right, exactly. And that's the kind of job that pays, you know, short of working as a teamster, short of working as a longshoreman, the most powerful, highest paid labor trade unions are the Hollywood labor trade unions. You know, it's not uncommon for people to make $75 an hour. They're going to sell their souls to the devil. You know, they're never going to be home to spend that money. You know, they're going to work 15, 16, 17, 18 hour days. But, you know, you're part of this elite group of engineers, you know, that are making all this money. They're working in the trenches on the front line of these incredible shows. You know, I spent time recently working on the Late Late Show with James Corden, and before that it was with I can't think of his name right now.
Give me five individuals that were very famous and that you met.
Well, I spent a lot of time with Montel Williams.
Really?
I did about 600 shows with Montel, and he was a singer. And I put together a band with Hank Castro. And him and Hank fell in love with each other like they were old-time brothers. So that was a very famous person. And then I also worked with Bert Convy. Bert Convy had won a Tony for his performance in The Music Man. He was the lead on the Broadway music, you know, 76 trombones. That was Bert Convy, and he was Mr. Game Show. And I traveled all over the country on a game show called Win, Lose, or Draw that was owned by Bert Convy and Burt Reynolds. Now, Burt Reynolds was a big box office star back in the day. Mm-hmm. And at the time that I was working with him on Win, Lose, or Draw, he was married to Lonnie Anderson. And we got to go spend time and live with Burt Reynolds at his home in Jupiter, Florida, which is like the Hollywood of Florida. And so that was a very interesting thing, you know, how people like that came into my life through television. You know, and I was pretty starstruck myself, you know. I mean, when you're doing those kind of jobs, Bethel, man, you know, if you see somebody like, I love Scarlett Johansson.
I did too.
Oh, my God. And she came on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson before James Corden. It was Craig Ferguson. And she was the guest on the show, and she was promoting Captain America, the Winter Soldier. And in the clip they showed, she does like this flying spinning kick, and she knocks out like five guys at the same time. And I wanted to so badly take a picture of her, but, you know, that they kind of frowned down on that, you know, because they're afraid you're going to take a picture with her and then post it on your Facebook or post it on your Instagram. And believe it or not, a lot of guys have gotten in trouble, and they'll call you upstairs and they'll say, hey, you got to take those pictures down. Mm-hmm. So, I've gotten pretty starstruck. I was working on the show with James Corden, and I got in the elevator, and Robin Williams and Brooke Shields were in the elevator with me. We were both headed upstairs, and I looked at both of them, and I said, oh, I guess we're both headed to the same place because I had my ID. But I had spent time with Robin Williams on my own, working for him as a musical director for the John Wayne Cancer Foundation, and Robin knew us. I have even pictures posted of him and I together backstage, you know, before he passed away. So he knew me already, you know, and you're hoping that they don't recognize you, because if they recognize you and they start to get all chummy chummy with you, one of the white supervisor may see you and say, oh, okay, well, this guy's fraternizing with the talent. Mm-hmm. We can't have that.
Right.
So we're going to have to take you off the show or something like that. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, Bob Barker, I spent a lot of years on The Price. Hey, who's the next contestant on The Price is Right? It's Beto Man. Hey, Beto Man, come on down. I spent a lot of years on The Price is Right with Rod Roddy and Bob Barker. And I had worked with Rod Roddy on Love Connection with Chuck Woolery. Boy, do I know my game shows. Mm-hmm. Not bad for a bass player, huh? And Rod was kind of interesting. You know, he was very demanding on the sound. He had done the introduction to, I think, the soap opera Soap. And there's like a introduction, and Rod Roddy was part of that. And he would do it for the audience on The Price is Right to kind of, you know, give him a little bit of his background and all that. And so Rod was having problems after leaving Love Connection. He was having problems on The Price is Right, and he wasn't happy. And I remember when they brought me on the show to replace the guy he was having problems with, and Rod Roddy saw me, he got so happy. And that made me feel good. Because, you know, I thought to myself, okay, even though they never really thank you or they never really compliment you, that's enough to show that I was doing a good job, because he just lit up. Hector, are you going to be here? Oh, my God. Oh, my. He was very, very complimentary, you know. And, it was, you know, Johnny Olsen was the guy who was the voice of television, the original guy that did all those game shows, was announcing, even on The Price is Right, it was Johnny Olsen. And so I thank God that I've had that opportunity to work with these legends from television, and that I was able to learn so much from them that I'm able to use in my career and business today.
All right. And you also received an honorary degree, you know?
Yeah, I owe that to Dr. Daniel Castro Sancho. He invited me to come to the East L.A. Annex in Huntington Park. It was a campus they had out there to give a lecture on the Hollywood entertainment industry, and I brought my Emmy with me. And I only did it because I saw this interview with Shirley MacLaine, actually Shelley Winters, the Academy Award-winning actress Shelley Winters, interviewed on a show with Johnny Carson, and she talked about taking her Academy Award with her. So I brought my Emmy with me to this lecture with Dr. Daniel Castro, and the kids responded really positively, and after the lecture he told me, he goes, hey, have you ever thought about like doing this on a full-time basis? I go, well, no. I go, not really. I go, because, I mean, I finished high school. I go, but I don't have a lot of college. I go, but I have a lot of experience. He goes, that's what I'm talking about. He goes, look, he goes, I think I can help you, and we can grant you your degree through Eminence. And he put me on the path, Bethel Man. It wasn't easy. It was not easy going up against the Academic Senate. They dissected me and put me back together again and dissected me again, and I had to prove everything 5 times, but I got through it. And they gave me an honorary degree for Chicano Studies and one for Broadcast Technology.
Wow. And so now you teach, brother?
Well, I'm off now. I haven't been teaching. I'm going up to the University of Santa Barbara to work on a project through the Davidson Library, where they're archiving the Rampart Record Collection. I've established the Hector Gonzalez Collection up there. And we're starting to archive things and... But as far as teaching, like I was before as an instructor, I haven't done that since 2010. But what I do, Bethel Man, is I go around all over the country and I do lecture. You know, I've been up to the Experience Music Project and the University of Seattle, and I've been to the University of San Antonio, University of El Paso, where I received an award as a filmmaker for my documentary on Rampart Records. So I do that circuit, and... that way I still am able to kind of be part of academia.
Cool. Awesome. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for us. I want to thank you for coming in. You'll come back again, ¿verdad?
Anytime. Thank you so much for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
All right. That's going to do it for us, Raza. We've been speaking here with Hector Gonzalez from Rampart Records, and we'll come back and we'll do another interview just on Rampart Records alone. But that's going to do it for us today, Raza. You've been listening to the Beto Man Chicano Highlights. Remember to always stay tuned to KUCR 88.3 FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Riverside. Also listen to KUCR.org, broadcasting simultaneously. Also, be in tune with the podcasting, EastLAReview.com. Review is REVUE.com. Also, TexMix.com. Órale pues, hasta la próxima.